Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility presents the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman, exploring ideas with innovators, change makers, business leaders, politicians, and activists. This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is underwritten in part by the Alchemist Brewery of Waterbury and Stowe, a proud B Corp using the power of business to support a clean environment and economic opportunity for all. Green Mountain Power, delivering clean, cost-effective, and highly reliable power to customers and offering cutting-edge products and services to reduce costs and carbon. UVM Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, the heart and science of medicine. Stowe Cider, with crisp, clean, and creative award-winning flavors. Visit the tasting room in Stowe or buy Stowe Cider throughout New England, upstate New York, and Washington, D.C. Let's Grow Kids, a statewide campaign about the need for more high-quality, affordable childcare in Vermont to better support our children, families, communities, and economy. Concept 2, designers and manufacturers of Concept 2 rowing oars, indoor rower, ski erg, and bike erg, and proud to support nonprofit groups such as Salvation Farms, which nourishes Vermont by distributing produce that farmers can't sell, as well as nearly 700 VBSR business members who believe that sustainable business practices value people, planet, and profit. Learn more at www.vbsr.org. Welcome to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. Today we're going to be talking about some of the goings-on in the Vermont legislature. We're going to be, later in the show, we'll be joined by Stephanie Yu. She is the deputy director of the Public Assets Institute. And first we're going to be going to Representative Tom Stevens, who is chair of the House Committee on General Housing and Military Affairs. This is a committee, well, Tom Stevens is going to tell us a little bit more about this committee. It's actually considering some of the hot-button issues in front of the legislature this year, ranging from National Guard, minimum wage, paid family leave, among others. Tom Stevens was elected in 2008 as the state representative for Waterbury, Huntington, Buellscore, and Bolton. He has served as chair of the Waterbury Select Board and president of the Waterbury Village Trustees, and he is presently president of the Board of Downstreet Housing and Community Development. Earlier this year, Tom Stevens was named Legislator of the Year by Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility. Tom Stevens, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Hey, thanks for having me, David. I appreciate it.
Let's start by having you explain your committee that you chair, the House Committee on General Housing and Military Affairs. What is it? What do you handle?
Oh, well, it's kind of easy at the tail end because with housing and military affairs, you're basically talking about affordable housing, and so the idea of raising money through state funds like our property transfer tax fund that's supposed to go to housing and conservation, that ends up being not so much the money doesn't come through our committee, but the policies on affordable housing do. And in military affairs, we're specifically talking about policies that affect veterans at a state level, and certainly oversight to the degree that we have it with the again. And then under the general rubric, it's really wide ranging. It starts with minimum wage with labor issues, so not just union labor, but just minimum wage, paid family leave comes through our committee. We do control issues, so we talk about alcohol, and we talk about lottery tickets and cigarettes, and the sale of those, and the fact that the state makes money from the sale of these products, and yet they're poison to people. So we have to kind of control the sale of them in order to protect Vermonters from overconsumption where we can. But we also deal with some pretty off the wall issues, if you will, things that don't quite fit into other committees. So this year, for instance, we have a bill that talks about prohibiting the viewing of humans for compensation for money, and specifically to the free shows that might have been up at the Champlain Valley Fair. It's on our wall. We have a bill that's talking about adopting daylight savings time so that we don't keep having to change back and forth. It doesn't mean these bills will become law, but they're up on our wall, and they fit into this broad category of general. We've done Abenaki relations. We've recognized Abenaki tribes here on the state level. We've dealt with
natural burials.
Well, let's focus in on some of the front burner issues. Let me just start by getting your response to the governor's budget address last week.
Governor's budget address was, and I would be one of the many people who said it sounded like the Phil Scott of old. You know, the people that we knew, the Phil Scott that we knew in the early 2000s and through his time in the Senate. It was reasonable. It was not contentious. There wasn't anything in it. There were things in it that I could disagree with, but generally speaking, there wasn't it wasn't an antagonistic speech, and the budget itself wasn't antagonistic to what we think, you know, Vermonters can work with. And so I think it was a positive step in the right direction in terms of the work that's going to get done on the budget and how we're going to provide some really important services to Vermonters.
One of the criticisms in the previous biennium was that the governor and his staff were kind of MIA during much of the deliberations and sort of showed up at the end and kind of flipped over the table and resulting in a veto session. What are you seeing differently now in terms of their engagement?
Well, it's a little early yet to see it in a complete and total picture. We've had a little bit of engagement with some of the administration officials, but also with people that we've had a good relationship with, like Commissioner of Labor, Curley, and others in her department. But generally speaking, I've just seen they've been more accessible. We've seen them in the building more, which is always a good sign that they're interested in reaching out to, whether it's key chair people or whether it's just, it doesn't seem to be as overtly partisan as it's been in the past. And I think that's a real positive. Last year was very difficult. I mean, it was my fifth term, and I had not seen anything quite so really radical in the way that people were treating each other in this building. It was really not the way that we like to see it or the way that I've experienced it over the last 10 years. And that was frustrating because...
Oops, you still there? Looks like Representative Stevens has cut out.
No, I'm here.
Oh, you're there. Okay.
Sorry, my ear hit the mute button, so.
Okay. the perils of my... Well, so what happened? I mean, you're talking about a real about-face, and of course, the proof is in what is actually, legislation that is actually hammered out. And so, as you say, it's early. But what do you think caused this change in tone?
Well, I'd like to believe everybody stepped back from the ledge a little bit and said that was not what we want to see, and that's not how we want to experience government. But quite frankly, the numbers in the House changed. The Senate has had a so-called supermajority for many years, and the House, we gained back the 12 seats that we've lost over the last two cycles, and so we're back at a number where we were back in through the 2014 election, which is with 95 Democrats in the seats. Now we're a broad tent, and we're not all in the same wavelength when it comes to a lot of these policies. There's certainly plenty of liberals and plenty of centrists and plenty of more conservative Democrats in there. But I think the sheer number itself, in combination with the Progressive Party, has shown that we have a potential for a veto-proof majority, which simply means that we have to get along. You know, nobody likes to override a veto. I did it twice when I was a freshman, and it's an awful feeling. It means the system's breaking down. But now that there's leverage, I think the administration perhaps has seen that in order to get things done that are on their agenda, that they need to work with the House and the Senate together to get there. Last year, we couldn't override a veto, so the governor and the administration could dig their heels in on particular issues, and their veto stuck. And that's I think, right there is the simple political math.
You're listening to the Vermont Conversation. We're talking in this half hour with Representative Tom Stevens. He's chair of the House Committee on General Housing and Military Affairs. If you want to join this conversation, if you have thoughts about the National Guard, the $15 minimum wage, paid family leave, and some of the other issues that Representative Stevens' committee is handling or anything about the legislature in general, you can call us at 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. So, Tom, one of the things that was significant in this budget address was the governor said that he's going to raise some taxes and fees, something that he swore he would not do in two elections. How significant do you think that is?
I don't know, to be honest with you. It's an acknowledgement that things cost money, and sometimes the price of things go up, and so you can't just say, I'm going to flatline the amount of revenue that were coming in. And the increases that he's talking about are relatively modest, but there are also some good things. For instance, the fact that he's agreed that e-cigarettes should be taxed, for instance, is an acceptance of the fact that these products can hurt people and have health, repercussions for people. So rather than saying, no, I'm not going to raise taxes, which happened over the last 2 years, and sweep something like, the taxing e-cigarettes as part of that, kind of takes away from, took away from the health issues that were related to those products. Now, by proposing to put a tax on them that might be equal to the cigarette taxes, we're going to have an opportunity to at least limit the sales of those a little bit based on price alone. And so that's important. That really is important just from that. And that's one of the simplest things that he's proposing. Some of the other stuff, I think the jury's out on how you deal with the estate tax and how you would collect that when you don't know how many people of a certain wealth are going to die every year. But again, they have their numbers and they'll bring them forward to the Ways and Means Committee and to the Appropriations Committee. But I think it's, again, the fact that the door is opened a little bit, we're not aiming to rush in and say, oh my God, we're going to propose taxes on everything. But I think that there's a real, when there's an acceptance that the price of things goes up or that changes in policy sometimes require extra funding, that require extra fees or taxes, I think it's a good move in the right direction.
Well, we've got a caller on the line. Fred is calling from Huntington. Fred, welcome to the Vermont Conversation. What's your question for Representative Stevens?
Representative Stevens, one of the things, I know it's not a big thing, but it's a big thing for 50% of the population, because most 50% of the marriages end in divorce, but there's a thing on the wall for Alimony Reform Act. Alimony hasn't been re-looked at since the 70s, and alimony affects approximately 49-50% of the citizens, which affects bottom line as far as finances, not necessarily taxes, but it affects everybody's bottom line. And right now, it's just kind of a ripshod, whatever the lawyer or, how the lawyers present and how the judge feels. Alimony reform is trying to get more of a boilerplate, kind of like child support, fill in the blanks when it comes to an amount. Some people are paying alimony for life, and it can get revisited whenever. And there is Rick Fleming has a big push to try and get this change. It affects so many people. If that could just, I know it's not a big thing. It's not like the pot tax or anything like that or e-cigarette tax, but it is, in a sense, a tax, a burden on a good population of the state. Thank you.
Thanks for your question, Rick. Fred, rather. Tom Stevens, alimony reform.
Well, alimony reform is, I don't know what committee that's going to fall into, probably judiciary. But that's been something that's been, I know that it's been in the ether down here for more than several years. And that, but I cannot profess to know anything about the particular and the particulars in the bill. And I would suggest that we just keep, I'll go take a look at it and see what it's proposing. I just know that in years past, it's been a difficult reform to make. And I, and the fact that it does affect 50% of the people, I would hesitate to say that it's just a little bill. It's for the people who are affected by this. It's hugely important. And so I don't have a stand on the issue, but I would have to learn more about it before I took one. But if it's up on the wall, and if there are people moving it forward, then obviously it's an issue that should be heard. And it becomes a question of whether or not the committee will take it up.
One of the issues that is before your committee involves the National Guard, and many people are familiar with the really excellent investigative series by Jasper Craven and V.T. Digger regarding allegations of sexual harassment, sexual assault, and what was described in these articles, I think there were a half dozen of them, as a toxic culture for women within the Vermont National Guard. What is being done about this, and what are you learning about this?
The first thing I've been doing with my committee, now this is the beginning of a new biennium, and what that means is that, number one, I'm new as chair of the committee. I've sat on the committee for the last 10 years, but I'm new as chair. I have many, many new people on our committee. And so this is a time of year when we do a lot of the education of what's in our subject matter, what's in our portfolio. And so that's what we've been doing with the National Guard. Rather than responding directly right now to any of the allegations and the reporting that was done in Vermont Digger, especially considering that the Guard's reaction to them was pretty, it was pretty that they didn't really want to talk about it last December. And my goal so far has been to educate my committee on what it is the National Guard does, and what is it supposed to be. And so that's been taking into account things like Guard 101, what I'm calling Guard 101 and Guard 201, where we've had the Guard in to talk about all of the different nuances that exist in the Guard's foundation. And we haven't really touched upon the series quite yet.
Well, explain how the leader, the adjutant general of the Vermont National Guard, is going to be changing. The current adjutant general, Cray, is, among other things, has been quite outspoken in denying that there is a problem. What is the selection process, and where do you fit into that?
The selection process is unique, period, and you really don't have to qualify it any more than that. We are the only state in the union where the legislature, the House and Senate, the 180 members of the General Assembly, elect the adjutant general. And we've done this has been in our statute since the late 1800s. And it's a process that no other state does. No other state has a system where the legislature is allowed to do this, to vote for their adjutant general. What makes it odd, though, is that because we're the only state, there's no other guidance. And in fact, when we elect the guard, when we elect the adjutant general, we then pass over ownership, if you will, to the commander in chief, to the governor. And so that's kind of an odd situation. So this idea that we have direct oversight is not really accurate. We can, we can have hearings and we can hear what folks have to say, but we don't have a direct oversight that has any kind of accountability to it. And that's what's frustrating about the situation in the Guard overall, is that in the end, there's no way to hold the adjutant general accountable on a statewide basis. Our relationship with him is based on the state mission that they have, which is their primary mission. What we've done in the past, what we've tried to do in the past, is bring forward bills that much like the governor has suggested, but dating back 5 or 6 years, where we've said, hey, maybe we should be vetting these candidates in the best way we know how. Maybe there should be a committee made up of House members and Senate members and members of the public with military experience who can take a look at the vitaes of the resumes of these people who want to be adjutant general and get access perhaps to some of their personnel files in a way that gives us an opportunity to then turn to our peers who are the constituents of the adjutant general candidates and say, yeah, these guys are qualified, they have a clean record, we can, while we're not taking a position on any particular candidate, we know that these folks, and not just males, but females as in the past, are qualified to be the adjutant general. And that's a tough thing for people who are not in the military.
What are you looking for in a new adjutant general, given the backdrop now of these allegations?
I'm looking for someone who is going to be as transparent with us as possible, someone who has a leadership capability to really lead a culture change, or to at least acknowledge that there needs to be a culture change and to act upon it. Sometimes it just takes the person at the top to be the person who says, you know what, we're not treating women this way anymore. We're just not doing it, and there will be consequences for this. The Adjutant General has to be able to be the liaison between the legislature and the military. It's not an easy, and the governor. It's not an easy position to be in, but I think that at the very least, if someone is campaigning and saying they're going to change the culture, that we have a way of knowing that, and that we have a way of measuring that, because certainly that has gotten away from us in the last, you know, the last few years.
Talk about, let's move on to some of the other topics that your committee is dealing with. So both the $15 minimum wage and paid family leave were passed by the legislature and vetoed by the governor last year. How do you find a way forward that doesn't end in the same way?
Well, first things first, you have a situation where the bills from last year are wiped clean. So whatever the bills actually were when they, and then they were vetoed, we're starting fresh in the new biennium. So new bills have to come forward. And so we're going to, on the plus side, we think that elements of each of those bills were worthy of moving forward. So, for instance, the $15 minimum wage, which is the process for that bill, is starting in the Senate. They'll review the bill that was passed. They'll review last year, and then they'll review the bill that was introduced this year. If there's any major differences, they'll do the work on it and put forward a bill that will then pass the Senate or not, and then it'll come over to us in the second half of the year. We just started today on paid family leave. Now, paid family leave 2 years ago passed out of our committee with a very strong bill. The benefits that would have accrued to people who were able to use the system were very generous. By the time it went through a couple of different other House committees and then went to the Senate committee, it came back as a compromised version of that. So in that case, we're going to start with the bill that House General passed 2 years ago, or a variation on that, and then work with that. And also, we have to work with the fact that the governor, while there's not a bill for it, the governor has made a proposal that is different in concept than what we've contemplated in the past. And, you know, in the spirit of cooperation, we're going to take a look at it and see if there's value in the plan that he's proposed.
Explain for people who were not paying attention to that, what is it that the governor's proposed and what is it that the legislature last year approved?
The legislature's attitude throughout has been, and this goes forward with any discussion about paid family leave, is that it's a universal program where everybody pays in and everybody benefits to some degree. And one of the problems we've seen in the past with private plans that already exist is that a lot of them are, you only get about a 60% wage replacement with the paid family leave program. But some pretty progressive companies. Problem with 60% wage replacement is that a lot of people won't take it. They'll use up vacation time because that's 100% replacement. 60% isn't really enough for regular uptake of that insurance. So this House plan is proposing 100% wage replacement for up to 12 weeks of either personal injury or that hasn't happened at work. Or, for instance, if you have a hard pregnancy and you need to take an extra week off from work, this would cover it. And also for family bonding time and for care of elderly parents. The governor's plan, as I understand it, would actually work with private insurers. We were proposed to set up a public insurance company, much like we do for unemployment insurance, which we do very efficiently. But his plan apparently would use private insurance companies, and it would cost more than the legislature's plan does. But it would set it up so it would operate faster. But it also would be a system that he's doing in tandem with a hybrid that they would be doing with the state of New Hampshire state employees and the Vermont state employees, which I don't think has ever been done at a local level. And so there's a lot to talk about there. There's certainly a lot to investigate there, but it's a whole different process than what we're proposing.
You have, and here's a spoiler alert, you have an op-ed coming out this coming weekend in the Times Argus about homelessness. What is your concern about what you're seeing around homelessness and how it's being dealt with?
Well, homelessness in general is just chronic. While there are some people who we can track, people who are just always homeless and are always going to be homeless because they choose to do that. But, you know, homelessness is an economic thing. And, you know, it could be that the family is one paycheck away. We know that people have lost their job, a job out of their two or three jobs, and they haven't been able to afford rent. And boom, all of a sudden, you make a choice. Am I going to pay rent, or am I going to pay for food or medication for my kids? And often rent gets left behind. And we know that there's a big battle that always happens between landlords and tenants and, you know, who's bad and who's worse. And, you know, the fact is that most of the homelessness situations that occur are because of the lack of rent, the ability to pay rent. And there's also some huge aspects of mental health issues that come into play as well. There are some people who can't live in a multi-unit building that might be set up for people of low income. But it's a truly an economic issue. And, you know, as we've seen throughout the economy, the people who are at the bottom of the ladder have not benefited as much as the people at the top of the ladder. And it's incredibly difficult to develop programming that would prevent homelessness. We have some things that we can do, like build more housing. But the idea that we have to, we're never going to end it because people become homeless for different reasons. But we can certainly continue to provide the tools for the state agencies and the other private agencies to try to get more people into homes. It's hard. It's a hard issue, and it's really silent because unless you're homeless, you're not going to see the folks who are homeless, not in Vermont, not in the wintertime. They're in places that you would never imagine to find them.
Okay, well, we're going to have to leave it there. Representative Tom Stevens, chair of the House Committee on General Housing and Military Affairs, and the representative from Waterbury, thanks so much for joining us this week on the Vermont Conversation.
David, thank you so much for having me. It's just, you know, there's so much going on here, and I'm glad that you're reaching out and finding out what's going on in this building. It's important for people to know.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a short break for the news now. When we come back, Stephanie Yu, the Deputy Director of the Public Assets Institute, will give us her take on whether the numbers add up that we're hearing from the governor's budget address and in other spheres. So stay tuned.